Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. Occasionally, we interview leaders in the origins debate, like evolutionist Eugenie Scott and theoretical physicist Lawrence Krauss. Well, today, there's a new bestseller just out, Darwin's Doubt by Dr. Stephen Meyer. Now, after 22 years interviewing scientists and for our technically inclined audience, I'll just briefly remind you that Dr. Meyer is with the Discovery Institute and so represents the intelligent design movement, which challenges Darwinian evolution but accepts the Big Bang and billions of years of Earth history, whereas here at Real Science Radio, we present evidence that challenges both neo-Darwinism and the Big Bang timeframe. So to talk about his New York Times bestseller, Dr. Stephen Meyer, welcome to Real Science Radio.
It's great to be with you, Bob.
Well, thank you. Cambrian explosion. I heard it on the radio last week. It was called the Caribbean explosion, but I don't think
Dennis Miller.
Yeah. Yeah, that was funny. So could you tell us about Darwin's Doubt? That's the title of your new book.
Yeah, absolutely. And the doubt that Darwin had about his own theory is the subject of the book. And the doubt that he had was about an event in the history of life known as the Cambrian explosion, in which the major groups of animals first arise very abruptly in the fossil record. And Darwin was troubled by this because in his understanding of the way that his process of natural selection and random variations should work, that process should work in a very slow and gradual way. Mm-hmm. And yet what we saw in the fossil record was this abrupt appearance. He also had depicted the history of life as a great branching tree in which the trunk or root of the tree represented a single-celled organism and all the branches at the top of the tree represented the forms of life that exist today, and the intermediate branches represented all the forms that had gradually evolved from that first simple form to all the forms we see today. And yet the history of life in the fossil record didn't look like a tree. It looks much more like a lawn or maybe an orchard of separate trees, where each tree doesn't connect with any other.
Well, could we give the audience an example of the kind of body plans that were found? For example, I'm looking at your book here on page 421 about the exoskeleton, for example, of the trilobite. The exoskeleton, if Darwinism was correct, and this body plan of an arthropod just came about by gradual changes, then it would have to gradually produce an exoskeleton. But it turns out that something that we might think of as simply a covering of soft body parts is really extremely complex.
Right. There's an intermediate tissue that connects the soft tissue to the hard parts. It's all tightly integrated. The process of development that is necessary for the development of any body plan involves both the construction of specialized cell types and the organization of those cell types into the right tissues and organs. And so the challenge of building a body plan is actually very significant. It's one of the things I looked at in detail in the book.
Well, Stephen, you point out that just something like an exoskeleton, it requires not only do you cover the soft parts, but, for example, the mouth. And different limbs are covered in this exoskeleton, so they have to move in order for the animal to be able to feed and to mate. The animal's internal muscles and organs are attached to the exoskeleton. The skeleton has to be able to molt. These are extraordinary engineering requirements. The skeleton is involved in the animal's metabolism. So it seems that this is one of many examples of something that the slow and gradual proposed evolution of body parts, organs, and so on has a very difficult time explaining.
I'm impressed because I think you're finding out about this in the end notes to the book. You got into the details.
Yeah. Dr. Meyer, I have read the whole book, I think minus 15 pages, because the interview just caught up with me.
So this is Real Science Radio we're talking here. This is great.
Right.
Well, the other thing I should point out just about the trilobite, perhaps the archetypal version of arthropod, is that it had these extraordinary compound eyes. I've got a fossil on my desk of a trilobite with the eyes beautifully preserved, and you can see the little structures that allow it to function in that way. So you have these exquisite visual apparatus present from the very dawn of animal life in the context of a fully integrated, multi-part body structure. And all of the Cambrian forms represent this same problem. We now know that fishes are first arrived in the Cambrian as well, and they have, of course, all these amazing complex adaptations, gills and lateral lines and swim bladders, and you know, this is a real problem. And what I show in the book is the mystery of the Cambrian is not just the mystery of the ancestral fossils that are missing. It's not just pre-Cambrian layers not documenting this gradual transition, simple to complex. It's also the problem of building these animals. It's an engineering problem, and that problem's been made much more acute by our discovery in the last half of the 20th century and the first half of this century of the importance of information, both the digital information that's stored in DNA and the other forms of information that scientists now refer to as epigenetic information, information beyond the genes. Both are necessary to build animal body plans, and neo-Darwinism has a hard time explaining either type of information.
And Dr. Meyer, you have a section or a chapter in your book on epigenetics. We've only done a couple shows on epigenetics, but you do such a great job of explaining that complicated idea. And so it's not only the DNA molecule in the nucleus of a cell that has information available to the next generation. For example, the cell membrane apparently contains a tremendous amount of information. Organelles within the cell that seem to have information. And so when the cell splits, when cell division occurs, that information is automatically imparted to the next generation, even though it's not genetic information.
Right. It's transmitted membrane to membrane. And the pattern of there are these targets in the membrane that attract crucial morphogen proteins, proteins that are necessary to govern the development of animals from egg to adult form.
Right.
And the position of these membranes is crucial to the proteins playing the right function, yet those membrane targets, they're transmitted membrane to membrane bypassing the gene expression system.
I realize this is radio, so we can't show a diagram. Maybe if somebody thinks of New York City, Manhattan, as though it were a cell, and think of the bridges and tunnels connecting Manhattan. So if Manhattan divided itself, if it duplicated, so you had two, it'd be a horror story. But if you had two of them, it's like the bridges and tunnels and all the information around the edges of Manhattan would end up in the new duplicate. So
that's a very good analogy. I might steal that one.
You're welcome to it.
It's the precise pattern of these targets that are transmitted independently of the DNA. The proteins that make up the targets are gene products. They're made from the instructions in DNA, but their position in the cell membrane is not a function of the DNA alone. And so you have a problem. And neo-Darwinism has a problem. And this is only one example. There's four or five different classes of epigenetic information that I look at, including a sugar code on the outside of cell membranes. The cells are communicating with each other during the process of development using molecules that are encoding information, but not nucleic acids, they are sugars. So there's lots of epigenetic, beyond the genes, information. And here's the problem for neo-Darwinism. Neo-Darwinism places the locus of innovation, of creativity, in the mutations in DNA. The mechanism says natural selection works on mutations in DNA. The mutations provide the new form and structure, the source of new form and structure of new innovation in the evolutionary process. But if you need information beyond DNA to build a new animal form, you could mutate DNA indefinitely without regard to the improbabilities of generating new proteins, and those are very significant by themselves, and you would never build a new body plan.
Because
if body plan construction requires information beyond DNA, then mutating DNA alone isn't going to get the job done.
Right. In fact, for decades now, the whole field of population genetics, which ostensibly was the mathematical proof for Darwinism, it was all based on something that today we know was a very superficial understanding of inheritance. They thought that if you mutated DNA at a single nucleotide, like one point amino acid change, that that would introduce a new trait. Well, now we know that that's simply false. And so the very mathematical foundation that was proposed has had the ground under it cut away. So they are, I love what you do in the book. You present the mathematical work of Douglas Axe and others and show the extraordinary difficulty of just forming a single protein by a random search through what you call sequence space, just changing. If a protein has 100 amino acids, you have to try millions upon millions upon billions and trillions of alternatives before you might hit upon one that actually could function.
That's very, very well explained. Here's an illustration that I use to amplify that idea. Imagine that you have a bike lock, and ordinary bike locks have three or four dials. The three-dial lock has 10 times 10 times 10 possibilities, 1,000 possibilities. If you had a little bit of time, you could typically find the combination by trial and error.
Yeah.
Imagine now you have a 10-dial bike lock and with 10 digits on each dial, and you're a thief and you want to steal a bike, and you know that the security guard makes his rounds about every 3 or 4 minutes. So you set out to finding the functional combination, the one that will open the lock, by trial and error. Now ask yourself a question. Is it more likely than not or less likely than not that you will succeed in that task? Clearly, it's overwhelmingly more likely than not that you will fail or that you will not succeed. Mm-hmm. That is, in essence, the problem confronting the neo-Darwinian mechanism. The functional proteins and functional genes are actually vastly more rare among all the possible combinations and ways of arranging the nucleotide bases in DNA or the amino acids in proteins than that 1 in 10 billion chance in the bike lock. And I show mathematically in one of the chapters in the book, based on Douglas Axe's important work showing that genes and proteins are so rare among those possible arrangements that you have an immense sampling problem, that even given all of the time available to the evolutionary process in the history of the Earth from the dawn of life to the present, and that would be assuming an old Earth timescale of 3.8 billion years, you do not have enough time and opportunities to sample that space of possible combinations to have a reasonable chance of generating even a single gene or protein in that time of life's presence on Earth. Mm. And in fact, you would only sample about 1/10 trillionth of the possibilities. So it would be right. So it's much more likely than not that the mutation selection mechanism will fail to produce even a single gene. Therefore, it's not an effective means of generating new genetic information.
Right. Dr. Meyer, as you just mentioned, a 3.8 billion year figure, the young Earth creation movement has not put as much money into original research as I think the intelligent design community has. The creationist may be raising more money in total. I wouldn't be surprised at that. But a lot of the research, as I go through your book, what I get excited about is that you guys are not only going through the literature so that you're fighting the battle from a library, but you guys are doing the original research, state of the art, and you're confirming what evolutionists have found about the unlikelihood of the ability to just come upon proteins and enzymes.
Well, I was on Michael Medved's show the other day, and Michael asked me to what did I attribute the surprising popularity of the book so far. And my first answer was essentially a variant on the old quote from Newton about standing on the shoulders of giants. What I was able to do in this book was to synthesize the research of some of the key people in the intelligent design research community, Doug Axe being one of them, who spent 14 years at Cambridge very meticulously answering this question experimentally. How rare or common are functional genes and proteins among the space of all the possible ways of arranging the corresponding amino acids and nucleotide bases? that was a very important question to answer quantitatively in order to make this argument. My colleague Paul Nelson has done some extraordinary research in developmental biology, same with Jonathan Wells and Michael Behe and David Snoke, biochemists and physicists, both from Pennsylvania universities, did some really important work on this problem of complex adaptations and the population genetics that you were mentioning. So I have five separate arguments, critiques of the creative power of the neo-Darwinian mechanism, and in several of those arguments, I draw directly on research that has been done by leading members of the intelligent design research community. And I'm also drawing on research that's been done by leading evolutionary biologists as well, who are in many cases coming to the same conclusion that neo-Darwinism does not provide an adequate mechanism for explaining the origin of either genetic information or the body plans that arise in events like the Cambrian explosion.
We're speaking with Dr. Stephen Meyer, former geophysicist. He's since earned a PhD in the philosophy of science from Cambridge University. He is the director of the Center for Science and Culture at the Discovery Institute. Dr. Meyer, back when the movie Expelled came out, I think Mark Mathis, the producer, on the movie's official website, we had released a press release, and he posted it on the homepage of the movie. And it was this: here in Colorado, a group of us around this program, Real Science Radio, we suggested a movie marathon where people would see the movie every showing on opening weekend. And sure enough, the local theater chain in Colorado added the movie to another half a dozen screens because of the marathon. And we did that. I watched you in that movie 15 times that weekend.
Well, I'm sorry for you then.
Well, yeah, it was an experience, I tell you what. But when the movie came out, all the evolutionists who were saying that Ben Stein tricked Richard Dawkins at the end of the movie, that was so clearly not true. Richard Dawkins was very engaged in the conversation. He was answering the question. He was maybe a bit more forthright than he might otherwise have been.
He certainly wasn't tricked. Ben Stein's only trick was he gave Richard enough rope with which to hang himself.
Yeah. He basically affirmed the intelligent design concept.
Well, inadvertently. You know, Ben asked him about the origin of the first life. Dawkins admitted that neither he nor anyone else had an explanation for the origin of life, which, by the way, was the topic of my first book, Signature in the Cell. Mm-hmm. Ben asked him, well, then, if that's the case, why not consider the possibility of intelligent design? And Dawkins then considered it. And he said, well, maybe there is a signature of intelligence, he put it. And since I was writing a book at the time called Signature in the Cell, I kind of sat up in my chair when I heard him.
Right.
And then he went on to say, well, but if there is a signature of intelligence in the cell, then it must be of an intelligence that itself evolved somewhere else in the cosmos. So he basically posited an alien intelligence,
right,
to which Ben later told us off the set, that's what you call the ABG hypothesis, anything but God.
Right. You know? Yeah. People who saw that movie, they might forget the movie opens at the Smithsonian with Richard Sternberg. By the way, I happened to meet him once at a fossil dig in Glendive, Montana, the Glendive Dinosaur and Fossil Museum. And we had a dinner, a small group of us. That was very pleasant. But you are the author of the paper that Dr. Sternberg published through a peer-reviewed process in a local biology journal. And that's how this all blew up. And that resulted in the movie and Slaughter of the Innocents and on and on and on.
Well, and it's part of the backstory to the new book, Darwin's Doubt, actually. Sternberg was the editor of the Proceedings of the Biological Society of Washington, which is the peer-reviewed journal that is staffed by members of the Museum of Natural History at the Smithsonian Institution. And I submitted a paper there on the Cambrian information explosion because, as I've mentioned, the Cambrian event is not just an explosion of form and structure, it's an explosion of genetic and epigenetic forms of information. And I wrote an article, essentially an article-length version of what has become the book Darwin's Doubt, road-testing the argument. Sternberg sent it out for peer review. It was returned to him with comments from several scientists, all affirming the merit of the paper, but requiring certain corrections. I made them. Sternberg found them acceptable. He published it under the standard procedure for evaluating papers.
The president,
a week after it was published, the lid came off at the museum, and there was this huge controversy, and they went after him.
They went after him, and they succeeded in running him out of the Smithsonian. The president of the Washington Biological Society, he reviewed the file, the peer review notes, said everything was in order. But this is somewhat expected, right? As you get through your book in the third part, the last part of your book, you talk about why there's such a motivation to not even consider intelligent design, the idea of intent.
To the way of thinking of the people at the Smithsonian, and we encountered this last week, the book was reviewed in the New Yorker. The science writer of the New Yorker made a number of essentially backhanded compliments to the book by saying that it was a serious work and it would appeal to a wide audience and it was well written and it was reasonable. But he said it's a masterwork of pseudoscience.
Right.
The key word there is the pseudo. What makes the argument for intelligent design pseudoscientific?
Right.
Well, it's that it violates this convention known as methodological naturalism that says if you're going to be a scientist, you have to limit yourself to strictly materialistic explanations for all phenomena, even phenomena that we do not typically explain by reference to materialistic processes, such as the origin of information. We know from experience that information always arises from an intelligent source.
Mm-hmm.
And if we encounter the Rosetta Stone, for example, in the British Museum, you don't say, oh, gee, look what wind and erosion did. Instead, you infer that there was an intelligent scribe because the Rosetta Stone has inscriptions in three languages written on it. The Cambrian explosion being an explosion of information,
right,
I argue, points also decisively to intelligence. But that violates the convention that says you have to limit yourself to strictly materialistic causes. And so by the lights of the scientific establishment, at least the guy writing for New Yorker, that makes it pseudoscience. But that was also the grounds by which they attempted to expel Sternberg. It was that he had broken this unspoken rule by allowing a paper to be published that didn't limit itself to materialistic explanation.
And Dr. Meyer, you point out that even many branches of science look back into the past, whether it's anthropology or paleontology.
Archaeology, forensic science. We make inferences to intelligent design all the time. Insurance fraud detection. If you're investigating the cause of a dead body and you're a police investigator, you don't from the outset say, well, I will only consider materialistic causes. You also have to consider the possibility that the body is there because it was murdered by a person exercising intent.
Yeah, that word intent is so significant. When crime investigators determine a violent death to be the result of intent rather than any other cause, then they have learned something and they've used science to determine intent.
Exactly. And as my colleague William Dembski has shown, there are clear criteria by which we detect intent, by which we detect the activity of an intelligent agent. And he breaks them down in with analytical and mathematical precision, but a rough way of thinking of that is precisely this idea of functional information. When we find information, especially when it's in a digital or alphabetic form that is performing a function, that is conveying meaning or performing a function, whether we're talking about a hieroglyphic inscription like the one on the Rosetta Stone, or information in a computer program, or in a book, or embedded in a radio signal, and we trace that information back to its source, we always come to a mind, not a material process. And so when we encounter an event in the history of life, like the Cambrian explosion, which required reams and reams of new information, a veritable explosion of new information into the biosphere, the most logical thing to conclude is that there was intent, that there was a purposive intelligence behind that event. And that's what I argue in Darwin's Doubt.
Intent. And I like that word. When Jerry Coyne, you mentioned him a few times, we've sparred with Jerry Coyne. When he and other molecular biologists, when they argue, and they say this with a straight face, they say that when we sequence the genomes of, you know, hundreds of different species, that genetic sequence confirms what we have already determined through the Darwinian tree of life. It simply doubly reinforces the tree of life.
I have two chapters on that concept in the book. One specifically on the animal tree of life. And the first thing to say about that is that we do not have fossil evidence supportive of the animal tree of life.
Right.
So the idea been proposed is that the genetic analysis of the genes, what's called comparative sequence analysis, can allow us to reconstruct that tree and compensate for the lack of fossil evidence. But unfortunately, for the Neo-Darwinians, when that analysis performed, there are a whole bunch of problems. The first is that the trees that they generate conflict with each other. Depending on which molecule you choose to compare in different animals representing the different phyla, you get very different trees. Yet there's only one history of life.
Right.
So if you use a method that's sending so many conflicting signals, it's really doubtful that it's telling you anything definitive about life's history. But the second thing is that whole method presupposes what the Darwinian evolutionists say they're trying to prove. It presupposes that the degree of difference in the different sequences that are analyzed is a measure of the time that has elapsed since the two organisms diverged from a common ancestor. Well, what's being presupposed there? That there was a common ancestor. So you can't use a method that presupposes the existence of a common ancestor to establish the existence of such an entity, especially when the fossil record provides no evidence of it either.
They seem to, and I realize I'm speaking in broad terms, but I've been hosting this show for 22 years, 5 days a week. They seem, and I'm talking about leaders of the Darwinian, neo-Darwin community, they seem to take their conclusions and they assume that their conclusions are the evidence that prove the conclusions. They do this constantly.
I would have to agree with you. I see that over and over again, where some point I've made in the book will be criticized by, seems like a nitpicky criticism. The critics are often taking their own theoretical reconstructions of evolutionary history as if they were facts. And then if you argue something that contradicts those theoretical constructions, they act as though you've misrepresented the facts rather than challenged the theory.
Right. Can we go back to the time of Charles Darwin? He had an opponent, Louis Agassiz, who is one of the world's most respected scientists, and he did not agree with Darwin. And in fact, he made a strong argument from the fossils that Darwinism could not be supported from the fossil record. Do you recall his argument?
Well, sure. In the first chapter of Darwin's Doubt, I start out by telling the story of Darwin and his interaction with his primary scientific adversary of the time, who was, in fact, Agassiz. Darwin sent Agassiz a copy of The Origin in hopes that Agassiz would read it and endorse it. Agassiz did read it very carefully, making margin notes all over the place, but in the end, his verdict disappointed Darwin because he found that Darwin's theory was implausible, and it was implausible because of the primary evidence that we have of the history of life, which comes from the fossil record. Now, Agassiz wasn't simplistic. He understood the fossil record wasn't complete. And there might be some chapters of the history of life missing in the fossil record, as Darwin himself proposed as a way of addressing his own doubt about the Cambrian explosion. But Agassiz raised a really compelling objection to Darwin's attempt to explain away the missing fossils. He said, it isn't the problem with Darwin's theory, and the problem with the fossil record, he said, is not just that it's incomplete.
Right. It's the
pattern. It's selectively incomplete.
Right.
It's incomplete at just those places where we would expect to find or need to find evidence in order to validate Darwin's tree of life concept. Mm-hmm. We have lots of evidence of the terminal branches in the tree of life, the branches representing the forms of life that exist today, even stretching back into life's history in the fossil record. But Agassiz said we continually lack any evidence of the internal branches, and especially the nodes, the connecting points, would show that the branches had evolved from a common ancestor. And he said that this selective incompleteness made Darwin's idea that the missing fossils were there just because they hadn't been preserved.
Right. Right.
He said that was special pleading.
Yeah, it was systematic.
It didn't ring true.
Right. What was missing was systematically, we have the nodes on the end of the branches, we don't have the connecting parts, those transitional.
The connecting parts are the nodes, but yeah, we have the terminal branches,
okay.
Not the nodes or the internal branches.
All right, thank you for that clarification.
Yeah, no, exactly right. And Agassiz just found that selectivity very implausible.
And that for the next 150 years, I grew up across the river from New York's American Museum of Natural History, Stephen Jay Gould. I grew up back in the 60s and 70s reading Addicted to Science. Stephen Jay Gould said the trade secret of paleontology is that all these transitional forms, not all, but overwhelmingly, they're missing. And so what Agassiz saw immediately back in the time of Charles Darwin has only become further documented, to me, irrefutably. And so then, of course, we move over to the area of molecular biology. So not only does paleontology show that in a very short period of time, you have most of the body plans that will ever have appeared on Earth appear in the Cambrian explosion. Don't you say it's 20 out of...
Yeah, number of points are that 20...
You have 20 out of 26.
There are 36, roughly 36 total phyla that have existed on planet Earth, and 27 of those are preserved somewhere in the fossil record. And of those 27 documented fossilized phyla, 23 are present in the Cambrian, and of those, 20 appear with no ancestral forms in the Precambrian, and the three that have ancestors back into the Precambrian themselves appear suddenly in the very late Precambrian and have no discernible connection to the other 20.
Which is also the pattern in the higher strata. So the complexity that appears suddenly in the fossil record are things like stomachs, intestines, gills, as you said earlier, sensory organs, mouths, nervous systems. In fact, you write of an arthropod, Opabinia. I don't know how to say it.
Oh, Opabinia. He's an exotic favorite of mine. This guy has five eyes, a really intricate body segment,
15
a strange
body parts.
Proboscis. Looks like something from science fiction, but it's a real creature. Yeah.
Yeah, and the trilobites, the ones buried lowest in the Cambrian, they appear immediately with compound eyes, focusing lenses. One of the world's leading scientists who has excavated himself these Cambrian life forms, J.Y. Chen. And you speak of when I think you helped to bring him here to America, and he was speaking maybe in Seattle.
Yeah, he's at the University of Washington, and he spoke, and he gave a brilliant exposition of all the different fossil forms that had been found. But at the end, he made some comments about evolutionary theory, and he said that the pattern of appearance of these Cambrian forms that are exquisitely documented in the fossils in southern China, the pattern of appearance turns Darwin's tree of life upside down. And he took his hand with his fingers pointing upward in a tree-like pattern and then just tipped it the other way with his fingers pointing down to illustrate that the major groups arise separately from one another and very suddenly.
And the reverse of what was predicted.
The exact reverse of what Darwin
And I love the quote. There was a question asked to him that you said it sounded almost like a threat. Shouldn't he be afraid to speak so openly?
Right, yeah. He got a wry little smile on his face. Nobody's fool. The geologist from the University of Washington said, aren't you a little afraid to be questioning Darwinism so openly, given that you come from an authoritarian country? And he said with a wry little smile, well, in China, we can question Darwin, but just not the government. He said, here you can question the government, but you can't question Darwin.
That is just...
it was his way of saying, whose country is more free? He knew all about political correctness in the American universities.
Wow, that's something. Eugenie Scott, in your book, you mention the predictions that the ID community makes. Back in 1998, I had Eugenie on the show for an hour, and I asked her repeatedly what was her best evidence that body plans or higher level organs, you know, vision systems, hearing, mobility, that these things evolved. And she finally did give me what it was her first, and I guess her best evidence at the time was junk DNA. And Stephen, when she said that, I said, well, Eugenie, don't you think we're just beginning to understand genomes, genetics? We've got a long way to go before we could declare that this is non-functional. And she said, no, we know what we need to know to affirmatively declare that this is non-functional.
I'd like to have the tape, the transcript.
We have it. We re-air it once a year. I'll send that to you, Stephen. And what I said to her was, Eugenie, I'm going to give you a chance to retract what you've just said, because we're writing down the date, the time. We're saving the tape. So fast forward to 2000.
Well, you were in effect making a prediction based on the idea of intelligent design, because and many, many ID researchers in the 1990s made that same prediction, that if the genome was intelligently designed, then we wouldn't deny that there were any mutations at all, but we would deny that the signal would be dwarfed by the noise, that is, that the majority of the genome would be junk and non-functional. The Darwinian prediction is the opposite. The Darwinists expect that because genetic information is generated, in their view, by the random process, trial and error process of mutation and selection, that process would generate a lot of detritus, a lot of unuseful trials of sections of DNA. And so when the non-coding regions of the genome were first discovered, the scientists assumed that those sections of the genome that did not code for protein...
It was junk.
...must be non-functional, must be junk.
And evidence
so we
of
had
evolution.
A discriminating prediction between the two models.
Right.
That was made in the 90s and repeated. And I repeated it in 2009 in one of the appendices to Signature in the Cell. I listed 10 predictions of the theory of intelligent design. Now, by that time, we were already getting a lot of evidence showing that the non-coding regions were functional. But the exciting discovery, and you probably alluding to that last fall, was the ENCODE project coming out with the conclusion that at least 80% of this non-coding DNA was functional, confirmed the prediction of the intelligent design research community, and also shows that intelligent design does make predictions that are different from those of neo-Darwinism, and therefore it meets that criterion of a good scientific theory.
We may have wasted decades, really, not looking at vital regions of DNA. We don't have too much time left. Could I ask you a couple questions, Dr. Meyer, about design and the ID movement itself? I definitely don't want to get into the dispute between young earth creationism and ID, but a couple questions about the designer. You guys at the Discovery Institute, you propose that there's a designer, and you use words like mind and purpose. I think you even use the word intent on this program. Those words, from what I understand, you look at the vera causa, a capable cause of producing the intelligent design that we see, and you see that comes from a mind. And so you posit that the designer, or maybe you guys would say, or designers, had to be a conscious mind making decisions. All that so far is accurate?
Yeah, let me just take a run at that. The scientific method that we're using is the same one that Darwin used, the method of inference to the best explanation, where the best explanation is one that posits a cause which is known from our present experience of cause and effect to have the capacity to produce the effect in question. Using that method, we can decisively affirm the activity of a conscious, rational mind,
right?
Because we have uniform and repeated experience of conscious and rational agents producing effects such as information processing systems, and integrated circuits, all of which we find in organisms.
Yeah.
So from the scientific evidence, you can go that far.
And now, you could see the result of a mind. We're almost out of time, Dr. Meyer, but you've heard the expression that the scientist finally arrives at the summit to find the theologian already there.
Well, exactly. That's from Jastrow's famous book on God and astronomers.
Well, yeah, and back in 1940, Erdmans published Hodge's Systematic Theology. And in chapter one, he wrote this about Darwinism. He said, "Darwinism assumes that matter does the work of mind. This is an impossibility and an absurdity." And so it seems to me that even before we understood molecular biology, we could simply see ecosystems functioning and the beauty of a newborn child, and we could see that there was a mind that had to design and bring these things to pass.
Absolutely. Agassiz actually affirmed the same thing. He thought the pattern of fossil appearance affirmed the acts of a mind, as he put it. ID people have different ideas about the identity of the mind, but most of us are traditional theists.
Right.
And I actually think that the biology alone gets you only to a mind, and that mind might be an immanent intelligence, as Dawkins indicated, or a transcendent intelligence. But I think when you bring in the evidence from cosmology and physics, in particular the evidence of design that we find in the exquisite fine-tuning of the laws and constants of physics and in the fine-tuning of the initial conditions of matter at the beginning of the universe, I think what we see there is evidence of design that exists from the very beginning of the universe and is built into the fabric of the universe itself, making life possible.
Because
I don't think that kind of mind or that kind of evidence of design can be explained by a mind within the cosmos. I think that points to a transcendent source. So I think if you take all the evidence of design from biology, physics, cosmology, you can make a very compelling case for a theistic design hypothesis.
Right. Like Richard Dawkins says, biology is the study of things that appear to have been designed for a purpose. I had on the show Lawrence Krauss, physicist. We talked about the appearance of fine-tuning throughout the universe. How about this, Dr. Meyer? When you look at our genomes, you figure out that the creator must have been intelligent. But it seems to me that you could also infer, in the exact same method you use, that the designer was living and personal and relational and moral. Because as you write in the book, you know, cause and effect, and we look at personal organisms, human beings, and matter and energy are not likely sources from which personality, people arise.
Well, and I turn the problem the other way. I agree with you. I don't think the pantheistic take on this makes much sense, which is an impersonal designer. What does that mean? We have no experience of impersonal minds. I think minds are things that persons have inherently. The two go together. So I think we're looking at evidence of a personal intelligence. The question is, who is that intelligent designer? And I think there are two basic options from looking at the biology alone. One option is an immanent intelligence, an agent within the cosmos. Another is the idea of a transcendent intelligence of the form that we associate with God. And I think the biology by itself can't settle that question. But I think if you bring in some other considerations, in particular from physics and cosmology, I think you get
to a transcendent,
a compelling theistic creator. Design hypothesis or inference. And obviously, I didn't go into that in this book, but it's something I've lectured on, a series of lectures called True You that were produced by some folks in Colorado with the Coldwater Media and Focus on the Family.
Yes, on the last page, you get close to it. Dr. Meyer, thank you very much for your time. The book is Darwin's Doubt. Dr. Meyer, could I ask you in your future research to keep an eye out for a particular kind of fossil at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, the nautiloid fossils?
Well, you bet.
It's the nautiloid fossils at the bottom of the Grand Canyon.
I'll have a look.
I think
they're gorgeous things, aren't they?
Yeah, the nautiloids, they look like an ice cream cone with a squid stuffed in the top of it. Well, in the Grand Canyon, the red wall limestone, the bottom 7 feet of that has millions of nautiloid fossils, apparently one every 4 square meters, and about 15% of those are buried vertically standing on their heads. I'm wondering, as you continue to look at fossils, if you could take special note of the nautiloids at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. Just an area of interest that we lately have been looking into. Dr. Meyer's book, Darwin's Doubt. Dr. Stephen Meyer, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for the great conversation, Bob. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, me too. Appreciate that. This is Bob Enyart for Real Science Radio. Our website, realscienceradio.com. Our store, in fact, we offer Unlocking the Mysteries of Life, Privileged Planet. What else? Darwin's Dilemma. It's all there. We did an interview a year ago with Jonathan Witt, co-author with William Dembski of Intelligent Design Unleashed. So check us out, realscienceradio.com. May God bless you.
Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.